You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Good to see you both, and and thank you. So
my pleasure
again. So here we go. So welcome everybody to Curiosity Invited, and today I am actually thrilled, some combination of thrilled and honored, to be speaking with two people who I have spoken with before, but not at the same time. Daryl Davis, who Daryl, wave. Wave a bit. There you go.
I'm the black guy.
He's the black guy. and the paler guy with all the books behind him is Jeff Scoop. So that's Daryl Davis and Jeff Scoop. We've had lengthy individual conversations, which are up on the YouTube channel, et cetera, et cetera. So I would urge you all to, if you're interested in finding out more about these two gentlemen's very rich lives, go there. But I'm gonna be bold and do a really brief description of a sort of a mini bio of both of you, and then you tell me what I got wrong and fill in what needs to happen. But Daryl Davis is a musician by training, by study, and professional musician for years, played with many, many famous, and depending upon how you feel about rock and roll and boogie-woogie, infamous musicians over the years. He is well known for that. And I would say, you know, especially as the world of the online world has grown, Daryl is probably more famous, more well-known for his story. He's a lecturer. He is a studier of human beings. And his claim to fame is that, well, the way the media talks about him, the way people usually talk about him is, oh, he's the guy who gets people from the Klan to leave the Klan and give him their robes. But he's quite specifically, he's quite careful about not making that claim. He does not convince anybody to leave, but because of their relationship with him, because of meeting him and connecting with him as a human being, many of those people do leave in organizations of intolerance, and in fact, and maybe he'll show us some pictures afterwards, but do in fact give him their Klan robes and insignia, etc. Jeff Scoop comes into this conversation from a different side. I met Jeff. I was introduced to Jeff by Daryl, and Daryl and Jeff know each other for a long time and are friends. And Jeff's entry into this conversation is he was in the American Socialist Movement for 27 years, and for 25 of those years was the leader of the American Socialist Party. Which is essentially was the largest Nazi party in the United States of America. And so Jeff has years of being at the helm of an organization that quite specifically had no time, patience, or a connection, very much of a connection, with folks like Daryl, black, were folks like me, in fact, who was Jewish. And And several years back, Jeff left that organization and is now actively involved in helping people, facilitating people's departure from those organizations, from hate groups, et cetera. And he too makes the rounds and is widely known, works with the Samuel Wiesenthal Center, and is lecturing against hate and against intolerance. And so both of these gentlemen have very rich stories. And I genuinely, I mean, I really liked my conversations. I was just so moved by both of my conversations with Daryl and with Jeff. So gentlemen, thank you again for being willing to. Jeff, thanks for getting up this early in the morning. Thanks for being willing to come back on and have a conversation, all three of us. So, but did I leave anything out that's worth saying?
Well, a couple corrections. The Simon Wiesenthal Center, and it's the National Socialist Movement.
National Socialist Movement. Sorry about that. And Jeff, anything else you'd want to say that I left out?
No, Daryl got it. He covered it.
Well, you know, the question that's one of the questions that's sort of been pressing on my mind, and I think worth saying is that, you know, Daryl's upbringing was not a cliched, the cliched version of what Black people's experiences in the United States of America. You know, he didn't grow up in the hood. He didn't grow up surrounded by rap music. But in fact, Daryl's parents, Daryl's dad, was in the Foreign Service. And so Daryl grew up in various places around the world and was exposed to, was friends with people from all over, people from various countries and various cultures, et cetera. Jeff grew up, as I recall, in Detroit. Is that right?
No, I'm in Detroit. I've been in Detroit for quite a few years, but I grew up in rural Minnesota.
Oh, that's right, in rural Minnesota. Yeah. And middle class, working middle class family,
yep.
Americana. And Jeff, I mean, you can tell that story if you want. I know you told it on the other podcast, but how you drifted toward the National Socialist Movement or Nazism or that. But I guess I want to ask you about like how you have been affected over the years. I mean, did you join that movement with, for lack of a better way to put it, sort of hate in your heart, and so sought this out, sought some way of expressing that, or was it a drift in that direction?
No, it was originally a fascination with my family history. My grandfather fought in the German army in World War II, and I wasn't brought up to hate or anything like that. It was just this fascination with the history and the family history, and the hate came later. You know, the hate came after being involved, being propagandized, reading anti-Semitic tropes and all these type of different things. So hate was something that was fostered there. It wasn't, and that's typically how it works for most of the people that are involved in it. You do have some people that are just, you know, they're just hateful, and they'll tell you, you know, I hate Black people, I hate Jewish people, and they join. But typically that's not the case. That hate is fostered and developed in these movements. And originally why people are joining is they think they're doing something good and noble. And of course we know it's not, but that's the mindset. That's the psychology of it, is they think that they're just like anybody that's joining a cult or any kind of extreme movement. They don't believe they're doing something bad. They believe they're doing something in their heart that's good. And that's why it's you know, understanding that is part of the half the battle to reach somebody too.
Mm-hmm. Was your upbringing religious? Did you have a family that, you know, did you guys go to church and like that?
My dad was a Christian, you know, so we did go to some church and stuff growing up. It wasn't a huge it wasn't every single Sunday or anything like that. When we were really young, most Sundays we went because my dad's parents, my grandparents on that side, would have Sunday get-togethers and things like that with the family. So it was pretty regular at that point. But as we got older and as my grandparents on that side passed away, we didn't have as much church growing
Yeah,
up. But
got it. And Daryl, how about you? Were you a church family?
We went to church here in this country. There was not necessarily a denomination. I'm also a Christian, but there was not a denomination of our Christian faith, you know, overseas. So we rarely went to churches over there. But later on, when I became a teenager and until my young adult years, I was a deacon in my church.
Oh wow, so you were in it.
I was in it.
Yeah. And your story is so different, right? I mean, you grew up in, as ecumenical and a rich an environment as you can imagine a kid growing up, right? Bumping into people of all sorts of cultures and countries and languages, etc. And I love the, I love, I hate, but I love that the story of your confusion, when for the first time in your life you bumped into to people who didn't like you specifically because of the color of your skin.
What was confusing to me, well, you know, as I first started traveling overseas to different countries at the age of 3 in 1961. I was born in 58. And my first exposure to school was overseas. Anybody who had an embassy in the countries in which we were assigned, all of their kids went to the same school. So I was in school with the Japanese ambassador's kids. The ambassador from France, you know, the different people, Yugoslavia, Nigeria, Russia, whoever had an embassy there, all their kids went to the same, you know, international school. And so that being my first exposure to school, that was my norm. And when I would come back home, I would either be in all black schools or black and white schools, meaning the still segregated or the newly integrated. And there was not the amount of diversity here in my own country that I had overseas. But also, you know, my parents took me all around the world. You know, you're assigned to a country for 2 years, and during that 2 year period, you know, before you come back to the States and get debriefed, you're given two sets of vacations. One is called home leave, and one is called R&R, rest and recuperation. And you know, most Americans would come back here for their home leave or an R&R. My father figured, well, listen, since the government's paying for it, you know, let's not go back home unless there's an emergency back home, because we're going back home anyway at the end of the 2 years. Let's go explore the world. So on the government's dollar, we went to Asia, went to South America, went to other places in Europe, Africa, you know, whatever. And I appreciated that, you know, during those years that I was overseas. But as a kid, you know, you think that every kid does what you do because you don't know any different.
Right.
And it wasn't until I would come back home, you know, every couple of years or whatever, and I would be in our history class or our geography class, and we would be studying the pyramids, the Sphinx, the Berlin Wall, the Eiffel Tower, the Mona Lisa, or whatever. I've been to those places. I stood 5 feet from the Mona Lisa before she had that shroud around her because somebody threw, you know, liquid on her picture.
Yeah.
I've been in the Eiffel Tower. I've been inside the pyramids. I've been inside the Sphinx. I've touched the Berlin Wall. I saw King Tut in his original coffin in Egypt, in Cairo, before it went on tour and came to the Smithsonian here in Washington,
I was
D.C.
about to say, you're not that
You know,
old, man. He wasn't alive, was he?
no, I hope not. So, you know, it was then that I really appreciated the things that my parents exposed me to, because it was then that I realized, you know, the closest many of my peers sitting around my classroom back here in the States, the closest they would ever get to those things that I experienced were the pictures in the textbook. Because most Americans, you know, don't travel. In fact, the US Census Bureau says that only 37% of Americans have passports. So I really appreciated that. And what, you know, what does all that travel mean, other than I have a bunch of frequent flyer miles and hotel points? It means that I have been exposed to a multitude of cultures, ethnicities, languages, religions, ideologies, and all of that has helped shape who I've become. That does not make me a better human being than somebody else who perhaps is less traveled. But what it makes me, or what it gives me, is a better and broader view of humanity. Well, and that's what I try to convey vicariously to people that I
meet. But let me ask you, when you are doing all this traveling, or since, did you bump into, I mean, look, there's bigotry and prejudice all around the world in one sort or another. Did you bump into, necessarily directed at you, but in Asia, you know, or in India, there's the caste system and what there was, right?
Absolutely. Like, you know, when I lived in Africa, for example, there was, you know, tribalism in some cases, vicious tribalism. A guy down the street from our house, he was of another tribe. And, when you work for the embassy, you know, you have guards, you have different domestic workers, you know, for the family. And this guy, his guard, who was also a member of that particular tribe, I went over to play with a friend of mine. And my guard walked me down the street to this little girl's house. And their guard beat up my guard, just beat him up on sight, just beat the daylights out of him. I had never seen a fight before in my life. I was a little kid, but I remember like it was yesterday. And I stood there crying. You know, my guard was laying on the ground bleeding, and this guy was kicking him and beating the daylights out of him. And I had no idea why. Now, of course,
was because he was from a different tribal group?
Different tribe, yeah. Oh. Now, later I found out, wasn't some conflict they had personal. It was a tribal thing. But that does not speak to all people in the tribes.
Sure.
You know, some of them, while they may not agree, they're cordial or they get along. But this guy just had a thing against, you know, this particular tribe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, I mean, you know, and you know, we don't understand that over here. Just like in Northern Ireland, you know, you have the Protestants and the Catholics who don't get along, right? I mean, some of them do. Over here, we don't even think about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Remember years ago, did you ever watch, were either of you watchers of the original Star Trek program?
Oh, that is the only Star Trek program, my friend.
Yes,
James T. Kirk.
I completely agree. But although I did come to enjoy Picard, but there was one episode where these two aliens were sort of, you know, one was chasing the other and seeking refuge, and each of them had one half of their
white,
body
half
white
black.
And
yeah.
The other half black, and yet they were enemies, and they were like, you know, the people from Star Trek, from the Federation, were like, what's the problem? You guys are both the same. And they're, well, no, he's white on the right side and we're right on the left side. And it really does. I mean, Ireland and England so remind me of that. You know, it's like, you could not pick these people out of any group. Like, there's no way to distinguish those people. Yeah. And the bitterness was unbelievable.
Yeah. And, you know, well, Gene Roddenberry, who was the creator of Star Trek, was a visionary. He was a genius, you know. In fact, the very first interracial kiss on TV was on Star Trek between Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura. That's right. You know, but before Star Trek, now understand how I grew up over here. All right. I watched The Andy Griffith Show. All right. I watched Leave It to Beaver. And before Star Trek, there was a show called Lost in Space. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Now, the family on Lost in Space was called Space Family Robinson, right? And had, you know, Will, Penny, Judy, the father, the mother, and the robot, right? Now, these people who were, and Dr. Smith, right? They traveled all over the universe trying to get back to Earth. They encountered green people. They encountered people with three eyes, four arms, purple people. You name it, they encountered. The only thing they didn't encounter anywhere in the universe was a black person.
Yeah.
There were no blacks on that TV show. Nowhere in the universe. You know, Star Trek brought it out, you know. So when I watched the Andy Griffith show, little Opie Taylor, Ronnie Howard, didn't have any black friends. Little Beaver Cleaver or Wally didn't have any black friends.
I don't think anybody on any of those shows, and I watched them too, was anything but white bread. I mean,
and all the superheroes that I had to model or idolize, Superman, Batman, Aquaman, you know, all these people, they were all were white. And mm-hmm. I remember when I was in, I think it was fourth or fifth grade, it was Halloween, and all my friends were going out to the 5 and 10 store and bought me a Thor outfit, Thor's mask and the long blonde hair thing and the plastic hammer or whatever. And I went to my friend's house to join the crowd to go trick-or-treating. Back then, you know, you didn't need your parents. People weren't passing out razor blades and poison candy. It was, you know, normal back then. And I remember a couple of my friends telling me I couldn't be Thor.
You can't be Thor because you're black.
Right. And that really hurt my I wasn't even thinking. I was just thinking, hey, man, you know, I like Thor. I'm going to put on a Thor mask. I'm going to be Thor. And that devastated me, man.
But okay, so between the time you're 9 and you get that, you have that experience where people are throwing things at you at the Cub Scout parade and your parents trying to explain that's racism and you not believing them. And between that time and later on, was racism growing in your life? Did it sort of amplify? Did it color what had happened before when you started to realize, wait a second, this.
Yeah, it grew, but it was balanced. And let me explain that. I was only here for a short time. You know, when we would come back, we would be here for like 3 months, maybe a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go back overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So every time I was home, yeah, I would experience something crazy, you mm-hmm. know, in relation to the color of my skin. But then almost immediately, we'd be assigned back overseas, and I would be back into what I call normalcy, with people from all over the world, you know, surrounding me. And nope, skin wasn't even an issue. That's why I didn't know what racism was until I learned it the hard way, literally. Boom, you know.
Right. And Jeff, did you grow up with any friends that were sort of obviously different, whether they were black or Jewish? Like, did you have, you know, some sort of, I don't know what to call it, multiculturalism, in your life? Or it was because the neighborhood was entirely homogenous?
It was where I grew up in rural Minnesota was all white. So
it was all white.
Yeah, it was completely all white. So you would have some migrant workers that would come work the fields in the summertime, but you know, they kind of kept to themselves and we didn't know any of the kids or anything like that. So I grew up in an all white area and really didn't even meet people of other races. I think there was one adopted Asian kid that was in town and that was about it.
Mm-hmm. But that didn't sort of lead you to mistrust, dislike, have all sorts of thoughts or feeling negative thoughts or feelings about these other people. You just didn't have any contact. Is that right?
Yeah, there really was no contact. So it was you know, being propagandized later on, you know, and hearing all these different you know, racial stereotypes and things like that and feeding into the big lie, basically.
Yeah.
Was, you know, you when you start looking for a scapegoat and you dehumanize someone else, you know, you don't see their humanity. And that's what I think that's the easiest way to explain it, is you just don't see the humanity in the so-called other, or, you know, when you're othering someone, meeting someone like Daryl, meeting other people. And then Daryl specifically, when he talked about how racism and hate affected him, these were things that when you're involved in this stuff, you don't think about that. I mean, you might hear it on the television, you might And that's what Daryl did.
You had nothing to compare it with, right? Like if you grow up in a homogenous world and then people start telling you about Black people this, Jewish people that, Asian people whatever, there's no, you don't even have, you know, any bumping into experiences from your past. So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to say what's really ironic about it is, as well is over all the years that I was involved in it, most of the violence that I experienced or most of the bad experiences I've had, scars that I have from fights and attacks and different things like that, almost entirely all came from other white people. I really have not had bad experiences with minorities. Now, a lot of people in the movement had, but for me, I just didn't have those negative experiences. So, a lot, you know, it's really, it's ironic. It's ironic, I guess, is the best way I can explain that.
Well,
sorry, I cut you off, Daryl.
No, not at all. To reverse quote somebody, let me say this to what Jeff just said. There are hateful people on both sides.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is a little bit.
But you know, when I first met Jeff, and
I was going to ask, how did you guys meet? How'd that happen?
Okay, well, a documentary was being made on the work that I do.
Oh, that's
and it's called Accidental Courtesy. So anyway, so the producer and director were flying me around the country, and I was, you know, meeting with different KKK people and interviewing them, a chapter of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And Jeff, who represented the National Socialist Movement, the largest neo-Nazi organization in the country, was invited to be interviewed by me. I did not know Jeff personally. I knew who he was. I knew what he stood for. I'd seen him on TV. I'd read about him, etc. And so the game plan was, we were in Alabama at the time, and he was invited to come to Montgomery, Alabama, where this meeting was to take place. And ready, and I drove over to the spot from the hotel. And as I was parking, I saw Jeff and sitting with a young lady on a bench right outside the grill place. It's called Chris's Grill or something like that. And we had a good conversation. There were some things he said that I agreed with, other things he said that I did not agree with. But we laughed and joked about some things. And I can tell you, you know, when I met Jeff, I shook hands with a stranger. But despite who he was and his views, when I left, I shook hands with what I believed was a friend, because I could see some commonality in him. Even in that first meeting, I could see who this person was. And in fact, after the interview, you know, when the cameras were off and all that kind of stuff, I pulled Jeff aside, and he and I had a little private conversation, just a man-to-man talk, if you will, about women, for example. And, you know, and we exchanged phone numbers.
And Jeff, like, had you heard about Daryl before this? Did you know you were going to meet this guy?
No. Well, no. Yes and no. So I had heard about Daryl. Of course, I knew about him and his work and all that. And normally with when filmmakers would contact me, I would do due diligence. I would look up who the filmmaker was, all this kind of thing. For whatever reason, whether it was fate, I don't know, I was being reckless, whatever it was, he told me. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is the guy that gets people out of the Klan. You know, I knew who he was at that point, but a lot in common. It was very surprising.
Where were you in your, like, in the trajectory of your 25 years? Like, were you contemplating, geez, I'm not sure this stuff is for me, or were you like fully in it? You were the director of the National Socialist Movement and you were like up to here in it. Like, where were you when you met Daryl? Where were you in that span of your life?
I mean, I think I was pretty hardcore still at that point, but it was right around that time period. Like, I always feel like Daryl kind of planted some of those first seeds. Detroit, living here in Detroit, I moved here in December of 07, but also being here in Detroit and experiencing, you know, multiculturalism, I guess you could say, or meeting people of all different races. White people are the minority out here. So it was having that experience and then actually meeting Daryl person to person, I think was the first major seed for me in the change, because I wasn't having a lot of those interactions with people of other races.
And Daryl, how long, I mean, obviously not to the day, but for how long had you been doing, you know, the work that started with the various Klan members at the, you know, at that fateful moment in the bar?
Well, it actually started a little bit before then. I had an encounter with one of Jeff's predecessors, if you will. You know, the first Nazi party, if you will, or neo-Nazi party in this country was called the German American Bund. And then it spread, and an offshoot of that became the American Nazi Party,
right,
which was founded by a fellow named George Lincoln Rockwell,
right,
about 30 minutes from where I'm sitting right now in my house. It was founded in a place called Arlington, Virginia, which is right across the Potomac River from me. Mm-hmm. I could be there in 30 minutes. And George Lincoln Rockwell was a major proponent of the ideology of Adolf Hitler. And he was always confronting in person Martin Luther King. They were always getting into it. Well, he had his right-hand guy was a fellow named Matt Cole, K-O-E-H-L. And George Lincoln Rockwell was murdered by one of his own American Nazi Party members, a fellow named John Palter, who got out of prison just a little while ago. He's dead now. But anyway, they got into an argument about something, and Palter shot and killed Rockwell. And so Matt Cole took over the organization. And Matt Cole, his right-hand guy was a fellow named Martin Kerr. And we had a class in my high school called, and ironically, one of George Lincoln Rockwell's daughters taught at my school. Now, she had long ago disassociated herself from her father. Wanted nothing to do with them, you know, didn't even want people to know that they were even connected. But anyway, we had a class in my school called POTC, which stood for Problems of the 20th Century. And we had a great teacher, and he would always, the class was for seniors, but I was taking it as a sophomore, as a 10th grader. And our teacher would bring in different speakers to talk about different things, abortion, this, that, you know, controversial topics, right? It's 1974. I'm 15 years old in 10th grade. And he brought in the head of the American Nazi Party, Matt Cole, to my school. And Matt Cole came with Martin Kerr. And they stood in the front of my classroom, and myself and another Black guy, I think his name was Herb, if it was Herb, were the only Blacks in this particular class. You know, we had more Blacks in the school, but in this class. And Matt Cole espouse all these views of white supremacy. And I'm just sitting there like looking at this guy like, wow, you know? And then he pointed at me and pointed at Herb and said, we're going to ship you back to Africa. And then he took his finger and made a big sweeping motion across the room and said, and we're going to ship all you Jews back to Israel. And I just sat there like, again, looking at the guy, you know, kind of dumbfounded. I'd never heard an adult talk like that before. And so I didn't say a word. And one of my classmates said, well, what happens if they don't want to go? And Matt Cole said, oh, they have no choice. If they do not leave voluntarily, they will be exterminated in the upcoming race war. That was the very first time I ever heard the term race war. Now, I already had the question in the back of my head, how can you hate me when you don't even know me,
right,
from my past experiences, right?
Right.
But I'd never heard the term race war. And that experience prompted me to go out and buy as many books as I could, learn as much as I could about this ideology. I bought books on Black supremacy, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, the KKK, the Nazis in Germany, the neo-Nazis over here, just to learn where does this come from. Now, later that day, I was standing by my locker in the hallway of the school. I was the only one there. Matt Cole and Martin Kerr were leaving. You know, they'd been there all day because they had other POTC classes. And they saw me and stopped right in front of me, about less than 3 or 4 feet from me. They didn't say a word to me. They glared at me and sneered. And then they started laughing and walked on down the hall. And I, you know, that just prompted me to learn more. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, I was 15 years old. And, you know, I'm 65 now. Now, you know, I had to learn more about this. And like I said, my generation growing up, we were taught to respect our elders as figures of authority, whether it's the mailman, the policeman, the librarian, whoever was older than you was your elder, and you were to respect them. You didn't have to agree with them, but you were to respect them. So that's why I did not confront Matt Cole, you know, when he said all this BS. I knew he was wrong, but, you know, I was showing, you know, this respect. And so now I graduate. I have all this knowledge from my books. I graduate high school. I go to college. I graduate college. All right. And so I graduate college in 1980 at the age of 22. 2 years later, I'm 24, 2 years outside of college. I've been attending all kinds of anti-Klan, anti-racism meetings. I didn't join any groups, but I attended these meetings. And let me tell you something, no joke. Some of these anti-racist groups were just as violent, if not more violent, than some of the racist groups, okay? And that's one of the reasons why I didn't join them. Anyway, I learned a lot from them as well. And I learned from somebody else outside that the American Nazi Party was going to have a silent, unpublicized demonstration in front of the White House right across the street in Lafayette Park. So I figured I'm going to go down there. I wanted to confront Matt Cole. Yeah. Okay, so I parked catty corner to the White House. The thing was to be at 12 noon. And I waited. And sure enough, you know, just before noon, here comes this this van. And about, I don't know, I think I counted like maybe 13 of these people get out of the van. These are the neo-Nazis, the American Nazi Party. There's Matt Cole and Martin Kerr, the same guys who came to my high school 8 years ago. You never, ever forget the face of somebody who tells you they're going to send you somewhere, whether you like it or not. If you don't go voluntarily, you're going to be exterminated.
Or be exterminated, right. Yeah.
So I see them, and Matt Cole is getting his people lined up on the sidewalk. Now, there's nothing that indicates, you know, they're Nazis, no SS insignias, Gestapo uniforms, swastikas, none of that stuff. They're all are in black suits. Ironically, most of them have these little black mustaches too. But anyway, they all line up, and they had placards, you know, holding in front of them, and they're facing the White House. Now, people are walking by, you know, not knowing who they are. I knew who they were because it's lunchtime, right? So I get out and I walk over right up to Matt Cole, and I said, "Matt Cole." And he jumped back, like, who is this black person that, you know, that knows my name? And he says, "How can I help you?" I said, "Do you remember me? You spoke at my high school." And he says, "Which high school is that?" I said, "Thomas Wooten High School." And he looked at me, he goes, "Yes, yes, I remember you. That was a long time ago. I remember that." And I said, "Yes, it was 8 years ago." He goes, "Yes, yes, I remember. What can I do for you?" And I said, "Do you recall what you told me?" He said, he nodded his head. He said, "Yes. How can I help you?" I said, "Well, I just want to know who gives you the authority to make permanent travel arrangements for me." He says, "What's your name?" I said, "Darryl Davis." He put his hand out and he shook my hand. And I learned something that day, how to intimidate people. He didn't intimidate me really, but I learned the technique. He held my hand in his hand as he was shaking it. He held it tight and continued holding it while he took his left hand and shook his finger in my face. And he said, "You know, what's your," I said, "Darryl Davis." He said, "Mr. Davis, you have to understand one thing. It is in the interest of your race, the black race, to be a strong race. And you cannot be a strong race unless you are a pure race. And you cannot be a pure race if you are miscegenating with other races. It is in the interest of my race, the Aryan race, to also be a strong race. We are becoming a mongrel race by miscegenating with mud races such as yours. So anybody who is a non-Aryan or Anglo-Saxon is what's called a mud race. And, you know, he went on espousing, the, you know, he finally let go of my hand, but he went on and espousing these views. We had a good conversation. You know, when I say I was there to confront him, I don't mean I was there to beat him up or get into it like that. I was there to present my views and question him, you know, make him open up some more about this stuff. I want to learn from him. And so I did. And then I thanked him for his time. I shook his hand again. And not that I was buying anything. And it was there that he told me something during this conversation that resonates like crazy today with me. I mean, I've known about it for a long time, but in 1982, when he first told me this, I didn't believe him because half the stuff he was saying were lies. I knew they were lies. So I just assumed everything he was saying was a lie. But this was true. He told me in 1982 that if things did not change, that this country was going to be was going to become white people in this country were going to become a minority in the year 2042. He told me that in 1982. All right. And since then, I've been watching that. And yes, it is predicted that in 2042, this country will become 50-50, 50% white, 50% non-white, which includes Blacks, Asians, Hispanics, whatever, right? Probably between 2045 and 2050, it will flip and whites will become a minority. This is happening. So when you have sat on the throne of power for 400 years, you don't want to get off. That's all you know. You don't want to get off. You know, you look at our last president who was only there for 4 years. He thinks he's still there. He doesn't want to get off. Okay. So that's, you know, that's a normal thing when you acquire power. This is happening. When I first started doing this work 40 plus years ago, back in the 80s, right? There was the Klan. There were white power skinheads, and there were, you know, neo-Nazi groups, basically just those three. I mean, there are a couple other French-type people, but those three were the biggest. Today, you got, you know, the National Socialist Movement, the KKK, the alt-right, the Vanguard, the National Alliance, the One Percenters, the Three Percenters, the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, the Oath Keepers, on.
Right.
And they're all saying, come join us. Come join us. We're going to take our country back.
But I want to get back to how you guys that meeting, that first meeting where you walked in strangers and on very different sides of at least the social reality, and you walked away with a connection. Because that seems to be
I wasn't there. Okay, unusual. I mean, I can't, Jeff will speak to how he viewed me. I wasn't there to attack Jeff. I knew what his views were. I didn't buy into them, but I was there to listen to Jeff and try to figure out where's he coming from that gives him those views. If I can understand that, how he acquired those views, then I'm better equipped to address them. So I'm there to learn from him. And of course, if he would say something that I would disagree with, I would challenge him on it and he would respond. And, you know, I challenged him on a few things and then he had to concur with a couple of the things that I said. And then a couple of things, you know, we laughed about. But I don't think at any point did he feel that he was under attack. But I think at one point he realized that we were getting a little too comfy. And he went into neo-Nazi mode, you know, because he realized, oh shit, you know, I got to do something here.
Jeff, do you remember that? Do you remember that?
I do. I remember that vividly. Yes, yes.
So,
because
can you say something about that?
On my side of things, I was, you know, this was the reason I agreed to be in the film or any type of films was for propaganda purposes, even though we knew from the NSM standpoint, it wasn't going to be positive. It was still an opportunity to try to get the message out there. So I was willing to meet. And as Daryl said, you know, we're sitting there and we're just having this conversation. It was very relaxed. It was we were getting along. And in my mind, it's like the wheel started turning, like, wait a minute, we're getting along too well here. You might read about it or something like that. But when you're sitting across from somebody that's actually sharing a very interpersonal story like that and how it affected them, if you can't see or feel their pain or what they've been through, I think, I mean, that's it. That is tapping into that humanity. And when you're involved in these movements, you're kind of blind to that. So
yeah. Well, plus you also
sort of like pulling away the curtains, and that's.
We were going to meet in this little hot dog hamburger grill. And so the producer and director had rented me a vehicle to drive and left me in the hotel. And they were going to go to the grill, get all set up. And Jeff was going to come and be sitting in the booth, and they would call me and tell me, okay, time to come over. And they would film me walking in and greeting Jeff and sitting down having this interview. So they would capture our very first meeting on camera and capture the interview that I would do with him. So that was the plan. And they called me and told me, you know, they're ready. And it was very famous because that's where Hank Williams used to hang out. And write songs, you know, at the counter. He wrote "Hey Hey Good Looking" about a waitress in there. Anyway, I saw this guy that appeared to be Jeff sitting on the bench with this young lady. I'm thinking, well, that's the dude right there. I thought he's supposed to be inside, you know. So you know, I was a little confused, but you know, hey, I'm going to get out and greet him, say hello. And so I got out of the van and I walked over and I said, "Are you Jeff Scoop?" And he said, "Yes." And I shook his hand. And he introduced me to his friend, and we went in together to the surprise of the director and producer who were unable to capture that on camera because, you know, Jeff was outside for some reason. So anyway, you know, we sat down in the booth and we began talking. And
I didn't look up anything. They just pitched the show idea, and I said, well, that sounds interesting. Yeah, I'll come. And so when Daryl walked up, like he was explaining, I didn't know who he was until he told, but not before that. So I wasn't prepared to meet Daryl Davis. And I was really, you know, I might've actually, I'm glad I didn't, because I probably would have been a little more hostile coming into the meeting. And he is such a nice guy. We got, like he said, we just hit it off right away. And I had the same feeling about it. It was like, wow, this guy's really intuitive. He's really bright. He's interesting. He's funny. We have a lot in common. Just snap back into movement mode. And then I was like, I'll fight till the last bullet for my people. Just, you know, I just turned that light switch on. And Daryl was just kind of like, huh, well, where did that come from? You know, it was just,
this was all film. What was any, did any of this end up in the final cut of the film?
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you look at it, is it clear that there's a little there that it's comfy?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, we're talking about you know, Jeff is a musician. He's a former singer in a band, and I asked him, you know, what kind of music, you know, did you sing? He says rock music. I said, well, you know, rock music was, well, I said, well, who created rock music? He says Elvis Presley. I said, no, my friend.
Man, you walked right into that one, Jeff.
So, you know, I brought up Chuck Berry. And he goes, well, what difference does it make? You know, music is music. If it's good, it's good. And, you know, so, you know, we carried on, you know, so we had that connection.
Yeah.
And then he brought up, he brought, blacks have their own groups. You know, you got the NAACP. And I said, yeah, but. There are white people who are members of the NAACP as well, plenty of them. I said, can I join the National Socialist Movement? He's like, no.
What was that? I know this is a crazy question and you may have no memory of it, but that was the first meeting and you walked away with some felt sense of connection. What was the second meeting? Like, when did you guys see each other again, and for what purposes, and like, how did that, because there's this, you know, there's this amazing transformation, especially especially in Jeff's case, right?
At the end of the of that first meeting, like I said, you know, I pulled Jeff aside and we had a little conversation and exchanged phone numbers, and we took a picture together, he and I, and he asked me if I would text it to him, which I did, and then this was 2016, and then the following year was that major fiasco in Charlottesville, and Jeff was there. And in the interim, or somewhere in there, Jeff had participated in another documentary with a good mutual friend of both of ours, a female Muslim filmmaker named Dia Khan.
Dia Khan,
a great lady, great filmmaker, just a great person. And you know, he had some interactions with her, and he also began questioning that ideology, because here's this woman who was spending a lot of time with them. You know, when you meet somebody face to face and you spend time with them, even though you may not agree with everything, you establish a connection. You know, it's like I always say, when two enemies are talking, they're not fighting, they're talking. They might be disagreeing, but they're talking. It's when the conversation ceases that the ground becomes fertile for violence. And you spend 5 minutes with your biggest adversary, you're going to find something in common, whether it's you're talking about your kids or a movie that you liked, or you and I talking about Star Trek or whatever. You know, it's that kind of thing. It brings you closer, and that gap between you begins to narrow. You spend another 5 minutes talking with somebody, you find more in common, and now it closes again. When you get to this point, you are in a, whether you like it or not, you are in a relationship with your adversary. You know, it's a cordial relationship, and you know, you might not be going out and having dinner with them, but you are relating to them, and you keep on talking for another 5 minutes, it closes more. When you get here, you are friendly with this person. You are friendly. And by this time, you have found so much more in common that the trivial things that you have in contrast, such as skin color, or whether you go to a church, a synagogue, a mosque, or a temple, begin to matter less and less. So you think about this Muslim woman not spending 5 or 10 minutes or 15 minutes with Jeff, but spending days with him doing this filming. There has to be some kind of simpatico relationship going on. And he began to even question further his entrenchment in this. And I can let Jeff, you know, speak for himself on, you know, into this.
Yeah. So Daryl's right. And meeting Dia Khan and spending all that time with her, I was able to see her humanity. And that was Daryl planted the first seeds, and with Dia, that was the end of it. I mean, I stuck it out longer in the movement, and I probably shouldn't have, because I was trying to work through a lot of different things. There was a lot of complications and things like that with leaving. But they changed my life 100%.
But I want to push a little bit at that. Well, no, say what you want to say first, I really want to push about that.
Yeah, I want to answer your question too after the second meeting. So like, you know, you plant the seed, but that's not enough. You know, the seed has to be nurtured for it to grow. It has to come back and watered. I planted the seed, Dia nurtured it, it bloomed. And what you have is the result, all right? So the second meeting. So Jeff participated in the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, and shortly thereafter he was done. You know, he realized, you know, this is not where I need to be, this is not my thing.
Your relationship with Dia happened before the Charlottesville event?
Before, during, and after.
Oh, I see. Okay,
she was there with her. She was there with
me as well.
Yeah,
got it.
Yeah.
okay so
I had heard, you know, there was talk, you know, circulating around that, you know, that Jeff was, you know, he'd gone off the radar for a while. I guess he was, you know, introspecting. And, you know, and then I heard that he had resigned from the movement. You know, he was leaving, he left. And, you know, of course, there were rumors abound. Oh, it's just, you know, fake. You know, all those people are in trouble. He's just trying to distance himself so he doesn't get in trouble, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I, like I said, I saw something in Jeff when I met him. I saw something in his heart. And listen, I've been doing this for over 40 years, and I can tell when somebody's BSing me. I know when they're telling me what I want to hear, and they have some other agenda going on. All right. But I saw something genuine in Jeff.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.